to walk the road of peace, sometimes we need to be ready to climb the mountain of conflict.
Tommy said, Mr. President, you're wrong. Now that takes a lot of guts.
I'm for peace and quiet, Mr. Lute. It's why I came to the UN. Quiet diplomacy.
Quiet diplomacy, yes. Welcome to another month of A Foreign Affair. And what a month it's been, the continuing street protests in Myanmar, and really that is ramping up very interestingly, tragically too. No resolution in Hong Kong, real transition there, I think, and concerns over Taiwan. Add to this diplomacy on show in various meetings in our region, and one in particular we'll be discussing in some detail with our guests, whose favourite conversation is foreign affairs and who are very close observers of foreign policy. Let me introduce you. Natalie Sambi is a researcher and writer on Southeast Asian affairs, in particular Indonesia and its military. She's a non-resident fellow with the Brookings Institution's Foreign Policy Program, and she's founder and executive director of the independent Verve Research. Jonathan Perlman, delighted to welcome him back, editor of the Australian Foreign Affairs Journal and the world editor of the Saturday paper. And Michael Wesley, welcome back to you too, Michael, Deputy Vice Chancellor of International at the University of Melbourne. Nice to say hello again.
Morning, Geraldine.
Thanks, Geraldine. Great to be with you.
Now, I'd like to start with that first high-level meeting between the Biden administration alongside the Chinese Communist Party led by Foreign Affairs head diplomat Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi, the foreign minister. It was held in Anchorage, and I think everyone has heard about it, in Alaska. Here's an edited version of some of those opening remarks by the US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and that of Yang Jiechi, which obviously left many rather startled.
I have to tell you, what I'm hearing is very different from what you described. I'm hearing deep satisfaction that the United States is back, that we're re-engaged with our allies and partners. I'm also hearing deep concern about some of the actions your government is taking.
I think we thought too well of the United States. We thought that the U.S. side will follow the necessary diplomatic protocols. So for China, it was necessary that we make our position clear. So let me say here that in front of the Chinese side, the United States does not have the qualification to say that it wants to speak to China from a position of strength.
Now, the analysis of what that tone at the beginning of that meeting meant is quite varied. Some, like Australia's Hugh White, believe it could be the beginning of a new Cold War and, if we're not careful, something more. Others, like Thomas Wright from the Centre on the US and Europe, writing for the Brookings Institute, he said it looked like a debacle, but actually the exchange was a necessary step towards a more stable relationship between the two countries. So, I mean, this is a very important distinction and there's no right answer. It's a matter of interpretation. I wonder, Michael Wesley, what your thoughts are, please, on this.
Thanks, Geraldine. Look, I think the meeting is a very significant meeting. I think it will be looked back on as a turning point in global politics and in the bilateral relationship between the United States and China. I think we need to read the meeting firstly in the context of what happened immediately prior to the meeting. Of course, Tony Blinken and his team went on that highly publicized visit to Japan and Korea. And then going slightly further back, you had Biden's important speech at the State Department in which he talked about the centrality of diplomacy and alliances. So I think there's something really significant to be taken out of this particular meeting. The first one is that both the United States and China are really speaking to a lot of other countries other than each other. Obviously, they had some fairly sharp messages for each other. But really what the United States is saying is that the confrontation with China is going to be a central or the central pillar in US diplomacy under Joe Biden, that China is being positioned in American diplomacy as everything that the United States stands against. And what Tony Blinken and the Biden administration are doing is saying, look, if you are worried to other countries, if you are worried about China's behavior, then you will have the United States on your side. And they're also saying to China that the more you act as you are, the more countries will join us and isolate China. China, on the other hand, is really trying to position the United States as a power in decline, and therefore trying to say to other countries, you can't rely on the United States. Even though Joe Biden is back and looks like the old style of American foreign policy, this is a United States in decline, and you really shouldn't be betting on this team.
Yes, The Economist put it very strongly. In a way, China is more tightly coupled with the West than communist Russia ever was, thinking back to the Cold War. This presents the free world with an epoch-defining question. How should it best secure prosperity, lower the risk of war, and protect freedom as China rises? Engagement is the only sensible course, but how does it avoid becoming appeasement? So it is becoming clearer, Jonathan Perlman, isn't it, the way, I think anyway, even the formation of language around this?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that quote you read out puts it really well, because it's this strange mix of engagement with China and conflict with China that's going on at the moment and that remains unresolved. And I think that's what's led to these kind of jarring scenes that we saw in Alaska, because it looked like a Cold War style summit, and it felt like one, and certainly it looked like that at the beginning. But those Cold War summits, the imagery matched the actual contents of the meetings. I mean, there was real, it was a relationship defined by conflict and confrontation. And it was a very cold relationship between the Soviet Union and the US. And this is a different situation, because China and the US are so enmeshed. Their economies are so enmeshed. So on the one hand, you have these opening scenes which were really confrontational, but it's clear that behind the scenes, you know, the talks were engaging, and the two sides were engaging on real issues and real shared interests and often areas of tension. But and then you saw at the end of the summit, the comments were much more conciliatory from both sides. So I think the reason why we're seeing these different interpretations is because the imagery is not matching the actual tenor of the conversations, and that the kind of iciness that we saw at the beginning, the actual summit ended with much more conciliatory language. So I think the actual nature of the relationship remains unresolved.
Yes, look, just before I go to Natalie, I mean, it is very interesting what you say, because in this interesting piece by Thomas Wright, who's just saying, everybody calm down, it wasn't as bad as it looks, apparently Blinken and Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, just at the end, when they were going in for the private negotiations, called them back in and said to the Foreign Minister, Yang Yi, it's never a good bet against America. And then Wang Yi responded, well, it was my bad. When I entered this room, I should have reminded the US side of paying attention to its tone in our respective opening remarks, but I didn't. Which is really fascinating, isn't it, Natalie, to sort of see that bit of sort of, you know, jockeying for position?
Oh, I grabbed my popcorn. It was a bit of theatre, to be honest. And realistically, what are we expecting? Anything different? You know, China has had 4 years of antagonistic Trump policies. From DC's perspective, China hasn't changed a bit, even if they have a new president. So in some ways, I'm with Thomas Wright. They got real with each other. And so in a way, that at least gives the rest of the world some comfort to know what we can expect in future. On the one hand, none of us want to see the two major powers of the world, you know, head to head as such. But at the same time, at least we kind of know where we stand. And we see that China, in no uncertain terms, laid out the fact that it was going to be here to stay, laid out its plans for 2050 within the first opening statements of Yang. But I think we forget there was not only the chastisement of the United States by China, there was a sense that, look, it's up to the two of us to move forward. You know, Yang in his opening statement said, you know, we as the major powers in the world, we as the major countries. And so there is this little bit of acknowledgement that we're going to move forward. We have to cooperate, even if we're going to be competitors. So I think that still needs to be remembered.
And in a way, Michael Wesley, that seemed one of the things the point Hugh White was making is that if any of us think that there's going to be an easy resolution to these difficult summits by sort of saying, well, look, we will effectively run the rules-based order as we have, which he contended the Americans still think, that it just won't cut it with the Chinese, who fundamentally want to basically show and say, we are up there too, we are regaining our dignity as a world power. Now, you know, it is difficult to work out how you move forward with that type of equation underway.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. I think that really the United States is moving very rapidly towards a position really quite similar to how it viewed the Soviet Union in seeing China and the Chinese regime as a fundamental existential threat to the sorts of governance values that the United States holds dear. We went through a period of 50 years where the United States basically gave China a free pass. You know, it was a one-party authoritarian communist state, but the United States basically said, but we'll forgive you for that and we'll just get on with a normal business-like relationship with you. I think what we're starting to see is that the United States is starting to realise, and very rapidly, that China continues to be a one-party authoritarian state, but a highly, highly effective one and a rapidly growing one. And this really represents a fundamental challenge because the United States looks around the world and sees other authoritarian tendencies on the rise, and suddenly China starts to look like a viable model for other countries. So I think we're getting to a very Cold War-like situation where America starts responding to China not as a country itself, not as a set of policy challenges in a bilateral relationship, but as an existential threat to the sort of world the United States believes in.
Mm. And you've been writing, Jonathan, about Hong Kong. If you look at a real sort of case study in this, the overhaul of the electoral laws, which by all accounts will erode aspirations of democracy, but fundamentally alter a lot of presumptions about tone and about values and about history in Hong Kong, even the way children are going to be educated. An absolutely fascinating article, which I'm going to post on our website from The Economist, the best I've read for a long time about how much Hong Kong is changing. Do you imagine that, how are we going to engage with this type of major, major shift, which is clearly underway?
I think the situation in Hong Kong and Taiwan as well poses enormous challenge for Australia, for the US, because these are the red line areas for China. And it's very sad to see what's going on in Hong Kong. But Hong Kong and Taiwan may eventually come to the point, and maybe even quicker than we expect, where there will be a point of confrontation and where China makes it clear that it wants to resume those territories, and Australia and the US will have to respond. And there's no answer to this right now. I don't think Australia has an answer, but it could easily lead to conflict. And I think one note, we do need to distinguish China's ambitions for Hong Kong and Taiwan with its ambitions to influence other parts of the world. It has a different approach to Hong Kong and Taiwan, and we need to distinguish that when we look at Chinese foreign policy.
Right. And you think we could, you know, that's an interesting... Just how would we prepare people for that? And would the tone be, you know, how would you do that?
I suppose the question whether Australia is willing to go to war over Hong Kong or Taiwan, I mean, that's as straightforward as it could get. And it's a very, very difficult question for Australia and one that we're probably trying not to face at the moment. But I think it could come down to that for Australia.
See, it's just that what's also happening at the same time, Michael, is capital is starting to flow into Hong Kong with all the changes that are coming, all the things that we worry about. And there's capital is starting to see, I've been reading a bit about this, is starting to see this sort of new plan, enormous amounts of mainland capital, but also capital from the West is starting to flow to Hong Kong, suggesting there is some sort of modus vivendi. So that's going to make it a bit trickier for the people like Tony Blinken, isn't it, and our own foreign policy?
Oh, look, absolutely. I think that, to cut to the chase, I think that the world has pretty much accepted as a fait accompli what's happening in Hong Kong, that Hong Kong, to all intents and purposes, has simply become part of China. The dream of one country, two systems has obviously been killed, and that this will become part of the Chinese juggernaut. I think, however, we need to be slightly different in our thinking about Taiwan. The easy kind of route to subjugation of Hong Kong that China had, it doesn't have in Taiwan. Taiwan has vigorous institutions of its own, and it's got really significant support, in particularly in the United States, in Congress as well. So, and it's got very much more capabilities to it as well. So I have no doubt that once Hong Kong is a finished activity, that China will turn its eyes to Taiwan, but it won't be such a simple proposition for Beijing.
Mm. All right. Well, look, could we turn to Myanmar now? Can ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, really prevent more deaths and engage the Tatmadaw in any shape or form with resuming a more normal, continuing where they were going? I mean, what's your take on this, Natalie? It seems to be something, a bit of an agony for Southeast Asian countries that really hate having to deal in this sort of, in this arena, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, even more difficult with the fact that they've got their own public health crises and economic downturns to worry about. They now have to turn some of their attention and resources to dealing with one of their fellow Southeast Asian states. Look, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, ASEAN has to be the way forward because Myanmar in the past has listened to ASEAN. You know, peer pressure has worked. And so the priority for ASEAN, as you said, is to stop the killings. And if it takes ASEAN diplomats having to be like a broken record that killing your people will not solve your problems, then so be it. But there is a double-edged sword, obviously, with ASEAN being the way that it is. Its quiet means of diplomacy and its closed doors, you know, allows the countries to save face. But the appearance that it is doing nothing, the appearance that it's sitting on its hands and is not making a lot of progress, you know, can also leave the protesters feeling quite isolated. And also there's the challenge of engaging the junta, you know, the idea that giving them legitimacy is obviously going to undermine the standing of the protesters. But unfortunately, they have to be part of the solution. They have to be part of any kind of ceasefire. So as I see it, you know, the end to the killings, a ceasefire, that has to be the priority of Southeast Asia moving forward. And they're getting there, but...
amazing to see demonstrations, I think I read, against the Indonesian Foreign Minister, Retno Marsudi, who's obviously spent absolutely hours and hours on the phones between the US and Myanmar and others in meeting the person nominated by the Tatmadaw as the new foreign minister, meeting him at an airport, and that she actually got criticised by people at home saying, no, you are legitimising them. Now, I don't think I can ever remember that happening before.
Yeah, that was a really interesting time for Retno Marsudi. She was trying to engage the typical kind of Indonesian shuttle diplomacy that has worked in the past, but she was almost outmaneuvered by the Thais in this instance, who ended up bringing together her with the representative of the junta. So there is, as I said earlier, that careful line that I think ASEAN member states, particularly Indonesia, needs to play. She was very quick to release a statement afterwards to say that she was also engaging the representatives of the protesters. But as I said earlier, inevitably, the junta has to be part of the solution. And legitimacy or not, they have to be engaged.
See, the thing is, Jonathan, because you've been writing about this, the civil disobedience campaign that's underway there, and there's a very interesting, the New York Times reporting just this late this week about a very interesting sort of almost looked like the bourgeoisie deciding they had to equip themselves and start to train like an army for a real underground, you know, almost like a guerrilla activity against the Tatmadaw. But the Burma imports most of its staples and its energy supplies, which I didn't quite realise. So could chaos threaten the Tatmadaw in a way it hasn't in the past?
Yeah, it's interesting, and it sort of distinguishes the situation now from the last sort of big rounds of pro-democracy protests that we saw a decade ago, because Myanmar has opened up and its trade and investment is much more enmeshed, you know, particularly in the region. And that is going to influence the regime there, because they now face much bigger political and economic costs if they further isolate themselves. So I think that is a factor in the current standoff, and I think it's potentially a positive one, and that countries in the region might be able to sort of harness that economic and political clout that they now have in Myanmar to try and influence the regime.
Because, I mean, Michael Wesley, you've got things like civil servants going on strike. You've got a lot of resistance from the boycotts in the supermarkets to the goods that are known to be produced by the army, because the army's massively involved in the economy, that they've had to seek to draw money out from foreign reserves over in the US because they're running out of money. I mean, I don't remember, again, this type of conversation in previous crackdowns.
No, it's really significant, Geraldine. And I think, you know, we should also look at what's happening in Myanmar in the broader sub-regional context. What's particularly interesting, of course, is that the protesters in Myanmar are using the three-fingered salute that Thai protesters are using. And you've got two opposing tendencies here. One is the lurch towards authoritarianism and anti-liberalism among regimes. You've got what's happened in Cambodia. You've got Thailand. You've got Malaysia. You've got now Myanmar. But on the other hand, you've got these sustained popular protests, a lot of young people on the streets, a lot of very media savvy, educated young people, obviously not giving up. And so you've got these two very opposed tendencies. And just going to Natalie's point, I can imagine how anxious the Indonesians must feel, because they're starting to see Southeast Asia lurch in that kind of authoritarian direction, and the gulf between maritime Southeast Asia, stable, prosperous, relatively liberal, and continental Southeast Asia is starting to yawn very wide now.
Mm. And finally to you, Natalie, I mean, just, you know, when you read the phrases about the Tatmadaw, there's a heart of darkness in the Tatmadaw. They just seem to kill unarmed protesters without a moment's thought. How is this playing out in the conversation in Indonesia with that very rich, you know, media environment there?
I think there's a lot of mixed sentiments, and one of which is obviously that the Indonesian military had tried to counsel the Tatmadaw to transition towards democracy. So I can imagine amongst some quarters a real sense of disappointment that those lessons weren't heeded, and in fact the Tatmadaw has gone completely the other way, rather than seeing Indonesia as this sterling example of how their country could move towards democracy. And on the other hand, I think there's deep concern there about where Myanmar is heading. You know, what kind of role will Indonesia play? What does this mean for ASEAN? You know, what does this mean for Southeast Asia moving forward? So I think there's lots of mixed sentiments there.
Well, look, thank you all very much indeed. It has been a rich month, if an extremely disturbing month in some ways. Michael Wesley, Jonathan Perlman, Natalie Sambi, thank you for joining A Foreign Affair.
Thanks, Geraldine.
And Natalie is the founder and executive director of the independent Verve Research Group. Jonathan Perlman from the Australian Foreign Affairs Journal and the world editor of the Saturday paper. Michael Wesley from the University of Melbourne, where he's the deputy vice chancellor.